Good morning, Colorado. You're listening to the Daily Sun Up with the Colorado Sun. It's Friday, June 23rd. Today, it's time for the Sun's monthly music conversation with Sun writer Kevin Simpson and G. Brown of the Colorado Music Experience. Before we start, a quick message. We'd like to thank our sponsor, Pinnacle Assurance, a workers' comp provider now offering enhanced coverage across the country. Pinnacle provides protection to Colorado businesses as they grow, no matter where that may be. Pinnacle goes where Colorado businesses go. Learn more at pinnacle.com. Now, let's go back in time with some Colorado history. On this date in 1947, Governor W. Lee Nouse pressed a button to start pumping water through the Colorado Big Thompson Project, or CBT tunnels, one of Colorado's largest, most complicated, and expensive water relocation efforts. In the 1930s, diverting water to drought-stricken northeastern Colorado had proved to be politically controversial. Advocates included U.S. Senator Adams and Governor Johnson. Opposition rallied to Congressman Edward Taylor, who insisted that water deposited by nature on the western slope should stay there. But the project moved forward when it earned the support of President Franklin D. Roosevelt, whose Public Works Administration combated unemployment during the Great Depression through infrastructure projects. In 1938, construction began on 12 reservoirs, 21 dams, 7 hydroelectric plants, 95 miles of canals, and 35 miles of tunnels. Before we continue, join Jason Blevins virtually on June 29th as he hosts Hit the Trail, tips to stay safe while hiking around Colorado. Learn about trail etiquette, season conditions, tips to stay safe, and much more. The event is free to join and open to everyone. Everyone who registers will receive a recording of the event. Visit coloradosun.com/14ERSafety. Next, our feature story.
Hey there, and happy Friday, Colorado. We're going to talk some music history, as we do every month, with G. Brown, longtime music writer, as well as founder and director of the Colorado Music Experience, which is an online archive of audio, video, and articles covering every angle of, well, the Colorado Music Experience. If you haven't checked it out, you should, at colomusic.org. Welcome back, G. How's it going?
Well, Kevin, I'm still suffering the lingering effects of a severe case of Nuggets fever, but...
aren't we all?
I'm getting better.
You know, almost everyone recognizes that powerful voice we heard in our intro, taking a great Creedence Clearwater Revival song and giving it her own distinctive treatment. And it's always sad when we say goodbye to a music icon, but Tina Turner, who died late last month, had such a compelling personal story as well as an amazing career. And you did a terrific blog post on your site, G, reminding us, and I had no idea about this, that concert goers in Denver long ago thought that they might have witnessed her last big performance.
Yeah, this was in 1986, or that tour of that year. She came to McNichols Arena, and it was the last stop of the tour, which she said would be her last one. She said there were videotapes now. I don't have anything else to prove. You can watch those. And, of course, I don't want to throw her under the bus. She was not the first or last performer to announce a retirement and then renege or Welsh on that promise for whatever reasons. But it was great to talk to her at that point because she was reflective about what she had accomplished to that point. Famously, starting out with the Ike and Tina Turner Review, making incredible music, but suffering in an abusive relationship, got her freedom. The thing that might be lost to history is that it took about a decade for her to reach superstar status on her own. She left Ike Turner with ostensibly 36 cents in her pocket and her newfound Buddhist beliefs, and took a long time, some failed attempts at launching a solo career before she went ape crazy with Private Dance in 1984, just one of the great albums of all time, and her career took off from there.
Well, she also crossed over into acting, I think. I remember her in Mad Max, Beyond Thunderdome, but there were others, right?
Well, I certainly remember her portraying the Acid Queen in the film version of The Who's Tommy. I think that's what planted her in that Hollywood community. But I don't know, does a Pepsi commercial count as acting, Kevin?
the judges said yes. Yeah, we'll give that to her. So when we talked about a good clip from Tina Turner to play here, G, you had a great suggestion that also has a bit of a backstory. So tell us about what we're going to hear.
This is River Deep, Mountain High. It came out in 1968, and this was the big hurrah for Phil Spector, the famous producer, arguably the greatest producer of the 60s, with the Ronettes. The Righteous Brothers, the famous Wall of Sound, those mono versus stereo productions, little teenage symphonies is what he called them. And River Deep Mountain High with Ike and Tina was his opus, and it bombed. And that's what sent him into relative seclusion, as has been proven over time. He was a bit of a lunatic too, so I think it all factored in. But the relative failure of that song on the charts was certainly turning a corner. But that does not impact the fact that, musically speaking, one of his greatest productions and certainly one of Tina's great vocal performances.
And so here we go with a clip from River Deep, Mountain High. So, gee, a couple of weeks ago, my son was getting ready to head up to Red Rocks to see Quinn 92 in concert, and the weather was looking pretty unsettled, like it has been around here, and like they might be in for a rough time at the concert. So I forwarded him your Colorado Music Experience newsletter that featured a really great 40th anniversary remembrance of a Red Rocks concert that was also played in, shall we say, less than optimal conditions, because you never know when you might see and hear a musical legend unfolding. And you reviewed an up-and-coming rock group for the Denver Post back in the day with what I would call a lead for the ages. And I'll quote, "A lot of things had to go wrong for U2's Red Rocks show to come off so right." Tell us about that long-ago concert that you nearly passed up.
Yeah, I did. First, though, as a sidebar, Kevin, fantastic that you could say Quinn 92 without...
I had to look it up. I had to Google it. And there are videos that explain that, but I digress.
But yes, the U2 show, June 5th, 1983, it's been voted one of the seminal moments in rock and roll by Rolling Stone magazine and many other places. An interesting circumstance. U2, on their way up, had played the Rainbow Music Hall in Denver, a legendary theater, and got everyone in the area on fire. Just an amazing young band. I was on board. I heard their debut album, Boy, and said, got to keep track of these guys. They went up to see Red Rocks and vowed to play there one day. So the date was set, again, June 5th, 83, and they sunk every nickel they had into filming this to amplify their career. And at the time, it was the first time it had been done. we take things for granted now, things being taped or filmed up at Red Rocks or broadcast. Man, it was the Wild West, literally, filming up in the mountains. But they brought in a producer from England and staged everything, just no expense spared. And the day of the show, it was not a circumstance that you would put the proverbial dog out in. Cold, rainy, wet, putting to shame the recent weather we've endured in June here in Denver. It was just miserable. And the promoter famously said, you know, you cannot perform, you know, you have to move the show. And they made the offer that they would do a show the next night, two for one, whatever, indoors up at CU. But they had to film this thing. They were committed to doing it, and they pleaded for kids to come out just so there'd be someone in the venue as they filmed it. And they had sold 6,000 tickets in advance. About 4,000 kids showed up, and U2 put on this amazing performance. The idea that they turned all the adversity in their favor to come up with something just incredibly memorable. I say performance, and that undersells it. There have been lots of great performances. This was a communion, if you will, with their fans. They were just kids at the time, but they were destined for greatness. And it just all amplified within that particular show. And I was a very lucky boy. I was sitting at home thinking, well, I'll just go to that show the next night. You know, stay warm and dry. Something compelled me to go and attend, and I was the only reporter there, and cobbled together that lead that I never thought was that great, actually. I was kind of embarrassed by it, but writing on deadline for an overnight review, it's what I generated, and it got picked up internationally as that video came to be released as Under a Blood Red Sky. First time that people internationally learned about U2 and learned about Red Rocks. Up until that point, it was just another destination, but people could see our wondrous outdoor venue and turn the corner for them as well.
I think, like a lot of people, I own that, both the CD, and I think that it might have been released on DVD at some point, right? I think maybe it was one of the early ones, Under a Blood Red Sky. And you know, looking at the video of that concert now, it's, I think you alluded to this, what's really striking, and yeah, I know it was 40 years ago, but just how young these guys look at that time, and they really were kids with phenomenal talent and stage presence. And maybe it's just, you know, all the more striking because, you know, from our current vantage point, we know the great heights that U2 went on to reach. So what should we hear?
I always think of Sunday, Bloody Sunday, only because that was the song where Bono had that iconic imagery of him taking the white flag and appearing in the middle of the crowd, and waving it around in what looked like a Scottish moor with bonfires on the rocks. Very dramatic stuff.
All right, here's a clip from Sunday, Bloody Sunday. Well, gee, one of the many things to love about the Colorado Music Experience website is the great interviews you post via your own podcast on the site. And you've got a particularly insightful and interesting one up now featuring a longtime Denver performer who, for reasons I'll let you explain, recently received the high school diploma that he should have gotten in, and let me check this, 1966.
Otis Taylor, graduate. It's about time. Otis is one of the great stories of Colorado music. Grew up in Denver and was an outlier. That's his term. not mine. African-American kid who would ride a unicycle around town and hustling and was musically inclined, spent all of his time hanging out at the Denver Folklore Center, where under the aegis of Harry Tuft, he got to learn about his craft, went on to perform around here, went to Europe for a heartbeat with a record contract, didn't pan out, came back. He also performed with the guys in Zephyr, another legendary Colorado band, but got out of music and dealt with antiques, sponsored one of the very first pro bicycling tours, had a very interesting career until he got sucked back into music at a late age, right around 50 years old, and made incredible records with Eddie Turner and Kenny Passarelli, and developed what has come to be termed trance blues. That's an umbrella term for what Otis does, but kind of that one chord boogie that the legendary John Lee Hooker kind of started with, and Otis amplified that, doing trance blues festivals in Boulder to educate people about music. Just a really intriguing and phenomenal career. And yes, he was kicked out of high school because he would not cut his, at the time, relatively short afro. They said he had to cut it or he couldn't graduate. And Otis, being a famously obdurate person, said, see you later. And so he had been awarded his diploma here in his early 70s. And it's just a nice story.
That's great. Well, let's have a listen to a slice of Otis Taylor. What are we going to hear?
Well, this song is his homage to the aforementioned Harry Tuft and the Denver Folklore Center, which is was his hangout and certainly a big impact on his youth. Harry, turn the music up.
All right, here we go.
Harry, hey, hey, turn the music up. Harry, hey, hey, turn the music up. Turn it up. Oh, yeah. They don't care if you wait. They don't care if you're black. They don't care if you're big or fat. Short or tall. Just come on and sit around. Play your music. Play your music.
He really does have his own sound, Otis Taylor does. Now, you know, I thought we'd finish up by telling folks about some of the live performances from Denver's legendary Evetts Field that you've added to the archives at the Colorado Music Experience. So tell us about the new additions, G, and then pick one to play us into the weekend.
For those unfamiliar with the legend, Evetts Field was a nightclub in the 70s and really the first great rock venue in our town. Only seated 238 people. Ridiculous configuration, shag carpeting covering the ceiling, the floor, the bleachers. It was wider than it was deep, but every up and comer in every genre, from blues and folk to rock and jazz, even comedy, everyone played there. Some amazing memories. And the good folks at Listen Up, our local pro audio dealer, were getting their start and recorded a lot of these performances. So to access that has been a wonderful thing. We're so proud to be able to share this stuff with folks. We got four new tracks up on the site this month, including one from the Eric Burden Band. Eric, famously the vocalist with the group The Animals in the British Invasion of the 60s, and then with War, the song Spill the Wine. He famously sung on that one. Decided to launch his own humbly named group, the Eric Burden Band, kind of more of a hard rock thing that was going on in the 70s. But they readdressed some classic Animals material, including this one, one of my favorites, Self-Actualization Anthem, we'll say. It's My Life.
All right. Sounds great. Here is Eric Verdon's It's My Life. Thanks for joining us, G.
Thanks.
You can read more at coloradosun.com. Finally, here are a few stories that you should know about today. The Denver Police Department lacks effective policies for community policing and struggles to address low retention and recruitment efforts. According to a report released Thursday by the Denver Auditor's Office, those failures challenge the city's efforts to build trust with residents. Developing a plan to hire more female officers was among 16 recommendations made for the department. The audit also found that the police department should expand physical therapy services and create on-site mental health services. Chief Ron Thomas agreed to implement the recommendations in the report, which suggests making the changes within 60 to 90 days. Nearly 100 people are recovering after a severe hailstorm rolled through the Red Rocks Amphitheater before a concert Wednesday night. 7 people were taken to a hospital and more treated at the scene after 2-inch hail fell on the iconic venue in the foothills west of Denver. West Metro Fire Rescue said the people who were injured suffered cuts and broken bones. Hail was still coming down as first responders tried to aid victims. West Metro said between 80 and 90 people were treated at the scene. A new report from Stanford University that studies homes in Colorado and California suggests benzene levels coming from gas stoves are worse than secondhand smoke and some oil and gas leaks. After testing dozens of homes, they found benzene produced while gas appliances are in use can linger for hours if not properly vented to the outdoors, and the benzene drifts to bedrooms and other parts of the house. Researchers don't want families to panic, but they warn that gas appliances need venting at least and may need replacement with clean electric models. For more information on all of these stories, visit our website, coloradosun.com. And don't forget to tune in again next time. Before we go, we encourage you to check out a new podcast from our friends at KUNC called The Colorado Dream. Here's a sneak peek.
The new season of The Colorado Dream explores the Black immigrant experience in Aurora. It's told through the eyes of one African woman.
I would sit on the beach and just daydream about coming to America.
And the city of Aurora that's working to become an inclusive home for all.
In the last 20 years, we have a new face of the city.
I'm Stephanie Daniel. Join me for the Colorado Dream Newcomers Welcome. You can find the series at KUNC.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now a quick message from our editor.
I'm Larry Rickman, editor and co-founder of the Colorado Sun. The Sun is a public benefit corporation, and we rely on the support of listeners and readers like you to produce the nonpartisan, in-depth news that Colorado needs and deserves. Please consider becoming a Sun member for just $5 a month. Learn more at coloradosun.com. Thanks.